You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Matt Migaki, the vocalist of Cryptopsy and the host of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, where I sit down with fellow metal musicians. We talk all about their lives and music while sharing killer craft beers. If you've ever wanted to sneak backstage and share a beer with one of your favorite musicians, well, Vox and Hops is the podcast for you. This week on the podcast, I dropped an amazing episode with Dom Grimal of The Last Felony, Ion Dissonance, and Cryptopsy. There is this episode and over 450 other ones to help you enjoy life, metal, and craft beer. So what are you waiting for? It's time to become a Vox and Hops head. Cheers!
Hey there, everybody. How's it going? I want to tell you about a little something called the Fear the Riff Expo. That's right, Fear the Riff number 3. Coming back to Brooklyn, New York in August. Yes, I just double-checked. August 10th, 2019. So I'm going to be there. I hope you're going to be there. Sounds like it's going to be another banging event and even better than last year. So I'm really looking forward to that. I had a really, really good time at the show last year. And I hope to see you there this year because I will be there barring any unforeseen crazy circumstances. So Fear the Riff, August 10th, 2019. Be there or be square or whatever. You know what I mean. I'd also like to tell you about Gun Street Wiring Shop. Gun Street Wiring Shop out of Bend, Oregon. Custom harnesses for your guitar just the way you want it. Is it time to upgrade the scratchy pots? Is it time to add some crazy push-pull functionality? Is it time to just have better stuff in your guitars? Go to gunstreetwiringshop.com and they will hook you up with the finest harnesses in the business. And they will walk you through any problems that you may have on the install. You know, it seems a bit daunting at first, but really, if I can do it, anybody can do it. And if you do run into any problems, Sean will help you. So don't worry about any of that. That's gunstreetwiringshop.com. Go to it. Check it out. Love it. Know it. Own it. Whatever. Something. Go with Gun Street. You'll like it. Couple things. I'm going to try to make this quick because I've been a little long on these intros. I don't like to be quite so long-winded, but, you know, I got lots to tell you. So one, obviously, I still have a cold when I was recording this, so that's why it sounds the way it does. I apologize, but, you know, on with the show. And this episode's a little more businessy, which isn't normal, but that's really what Julie does, and I know a lot of you are really interested in that kind of stuff, so I thought it would be a good kind of time to dive into that stuff a little bit more and see how she looks at things from kind of a higher business level perspective. So I think a lot of the industry folks that listen to this will probably be very interested in that. And before we get started, I just want to do a quick reminder about tonemob.com/reverb. That link will take you to reverb.com. If you go through there, you can do all your normal shopping. Anything that you've been wanting to buy for Christmas, you got somebody on your list, even if it's yourself, a small percentage of that comes back and helps support the show and just keep it going. It doesn't raise your prices, doesn't make anything weird. And if this is the first time you've heard of Reverb, which would be very surprising, but if it is the first time you've heard of it, just signing up helps. You go to tonemob.com/reverb and just sign up for an account. That helps us out too. So if you could just do that for me, bookmark it, save it, use it. Anytime you shop on Reverb, it helps out a lot. And I really, really appreciate everybody that's already been using it. You guys have been very receptive to it, and that is very, very nice. So thank you. But I'll just shut my mouth. Well, I'm not going to shut it totally. You'll hear me in a sec. You know how this works. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the ToneMob.com podcast, a show about guitar tone and the people behind it. I'm your host, Blake Weiland, and with me today, I have Julie Robbins from Earthquaker Devices. What's happening?
Oh, not too much. How are you?
Doing good. Doing good. I'm just deep in podcast mode today. So some things changed, and I'm doing like three episodes a day. So we're doing it.
That's awesome.
I'm kind of used to I'm not always recording, but yesterday, and you can probably relate to this, yesterday I was on the phone for 7.5 hours.
Oh my god.
Between all the phone calls. So I'm used to talking a lot. It's just
wow,
what happens. So
yeah, if I talk that much, I lose my voice. I try and conserve it.
I'm doing okay. I thought it might be a little scratchier than it is, but I'm just kind of getting over that cold I was telling you about. So it's a little bit weird.
Well, I'm glad you're on the mend.
Doing okay. But I think we should just start off, like, I know that a lot of the industry people know that you have a super heavy hand in Earthquaker, but I don't know if as many of the consumers know your story. So it'd be good to probably start off with, like, what is your backstory and how did you become a part of EQD and what your kind of day-to-day looks like?
Wow. Okay. So let's see. I met Jamie when we were really young. I was 20. He was 22. And he was a touring guitar player. He had a record label. I was a single mother college student. And our first sort of endeavor together was he had a record label and bands, and I started booking tours for his bands. We both have always been pretty entrepreneurial. So in the early 2000s, I had a booking agency called Musical Adventures, and I booked a bunch of tours for bands. And, you know, I've never been a musician, but I've always had a lot of friends that were musicians, and that was pretty much my life for a few years, booking tours, and I booked a couple clubs. And then at some point it became, we had to get some sort of stable income. So I went to work for a bank. And during that time, Jamie, you know, did all sorts of things, including graphic design, tour managing. We were selling like random crap on eBay to just kind of pay the bills. And when he started doing Earthquaker, it was sort of a thing where I'd come home from the bank and he'd be like, can you help me assemble all these pedals? And, you know, I'd spend my evenings assembling pedals. And then it sort of gradually grew to the point that in 2012, I felt like we could go all in on Earthquaker. And one of the big sort of deciding factors for us was health insurance. I was really concerned about getting health insurance. And it turned out not to be as difficult as I thought it would be. And it turned out to be actually less expensive than what I was paying at the bank.
Oh, wow.
For our family plan. And so I left my job at the bank after about 9 years and came on to Earthquaker full time. So, yeah. And my education is in economics and political science. So I don't, you know, nobody here has like a business degree, but I'm pretty democratic in my kind of leadership style. I don't pretend that I know everything, but I think I have a lot of smart and good intentioned people around me. So I take a lot of feedback from my team.
Yeah. So that's really interesting, because like for somebody who's like, I mean, you definitely surrounded yourself with music and musicians, but I was actually, it didn't even cross my mind the fact that you weren't one yourself. I just kind of assumed you were because you're heavily involved in all this stuff. So I just kind of thought, oh, yeah, yeah. She probably plays something.
Yeah. Well, somebody has to think about something else once in a while. So I feel really, you know, fine about it. Every once in a while, I have a dream that I can, like, play guitar. Like, I've had dreams that we've been at a store and there was nobody around to, like, show them a pedal. And I was like, all right, I'll do it. And then I just start playing guitar really well. Jamie makes it look easy, but.
Yeah, I understand. Is that, like, sort of, is that almost like a, you know, a nightmare situation where it's like, oh, no, I'm put on the spot. Or, and it's like you just overcome somehow.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So from what Jamie was telling me, it sounds like your day to day is a lot different than his day to day. What does your typical day look like over there?
Well, so I am usually in my office or in a meeting. I have all kinds of things on my plate. I'm usually juggling like 20 things. There's usually people in and out of my office bringing me, you know, questions or problems of varying degrees of intensity. So, yeah, I'm sort of, you know, managing everything. I'm, you know, really involved in all things cash flow related. I guess I would say sort of trying to steer the ship and help everybody understand their priorities and how to get from where we are to where we're trying to get to, that sort of thing.
So, you know, not having a business background per se, was it surprising you to find that you had strengths in kind of organizing these systems and doing these things? Or are you kind of, that's just your natural inclination?
I think in a lot of ways it is my natural inclination. I don't think that I ever like had any designs on managing a lot of people. I think that I would be content to just sort of like, you know, handle my own stuff. But I saw that somebody needed to do that. And so I sort of stepped up. I think that I'm good at kind of creating teams and seeing where our attention should be and finding the right people. I think those would be my strengths, you know. And I'm also, you know, pretty analytical and always kind of been very budget minded. So. Yeah, it is a surprise to me. I don't think I would have ever dreamed that I would be in this position one day. Although it's not surprising, like seeing Jamie and his trajectory, it seems like it should have gone this way.
Yeah, it does seem that his position there is a very good fit for him as a person, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. He definitely could not work for someone else, you know? He needs to be in charge of his own thing and in control of his own destiny, for sure.
Was there, I'm not sure what the right way to phrase this is. Was there anything that surprised you, like kind of really getting into the pedal industry in like a serious way? Was there anything that surprised you by that? You know, because you're not a guitar player. So it's like that people are this passionate about it or what?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of things that surprise me about the industry. I mean, it's first of all, like the intensity of, you know, the pedal community, pedal fans is like the level of nerdiery is so high. you know, they're talking about scooping mids like it's curing cancer or something. But, you know, when you're sort of a step or two removed from all of the nuances and subtleties of the tone, and you're sort of looking at it objectively, you're like, wow. You know, first of all, it's like a luxury item. You know, it's not anything that you need. So it's sort of shocking that it's such a big industry, you know, and there's things that will do a thing, you know. You can get a reverb for what, like $40? You can get a reverb for like $500, you know? So it's almost like in some ways, pure capitalism doesn't apply. Like there's something, some extra factor there that could be maybe an addiction or something like that. That is... you may have it.
I don't know how many pedals I have. But it,
it's last time I counted, it was around 160, and that was a while ago. So I don't know if that constitutes an addiction or an obsession or what, but it's definitely fun.
Yeah. I mean, it's really cool, but it, like, in a lot of ways just sort of defies logic. You know what I mean? So those things all struck me as very interesting. I can't think of any other industries that work the same way that ours does. You know, there's a lot of camaraderie among, you know, people that are technically in competition with each other. It also seems like the type of people that own pedal companies are not, you know, cutthroat businessmen, that it's all about the bottom line. And, you know, we're not like that. So it seems like that's a pretty common thing across the industry. Yeah, just off the top of my head, that's a couple things that really surprised me.
I think that this industry attracts a certain type of person for the most part. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's outliers everywhere, of course, but, like, for the most part, you're right. Like, nobody really got into this, in my opinion. Like, very few people got into this going, like, I'm going to make piles of cash.
Right.
It's like, and if you did, you kind of, you know, well, there's a rude awakening for you about to happen. It's more like, this stuff is just so fun for most of us. It's so, I know for me, it was like, I, like, ramrodded my way into it, sort of. I was like, I don't know how to build anything. I don't know, you know, I just know I love this stuff and I want to work in this business. And so I started this show and, you know, here we are. So it's, mm-hmm. you know, it does attract, I think, a certain type of individual, and those individuals tend to be pretty chill for the most part.
Yeah, pretty chill, pretty, like, a certain level of genius, I think. You know, it's really interesting. Also, you know, a lot of a lot of people that just probably wouldn't be cut out for, you know, working for somebody else, basically need to have control over their own destiny.
For sure. Was when you are looking at an effect, right? So the mm-hmm. since you are kind of removed from it, like, this is like a thing that you guys make. Is it hard to wrap your mind around, like, the kind of the passionate following that you guys have? Like, people love Earthquaker. They love
it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. Well, I don't know if it's hard for me to wrap my mind around it. It's just I think it is somewhat surprising, you know, especially because, well, like, in the analytical world of, like, data reporting for the music industry, effects are, like, classified as, like, an accessory, but we more think of them like they're instruments of their own, you know, and it seems like that's why a lot of people are drawn to our pedals. So, I mean, even though I don't play, I have learned so much, like, it's ridiculous. Well, I used to do all of, like, the customer support, and that involved me actually sitting basically where I am now in our studio, and Jamie's sitting about 4 feet from me, and me being like, Jamie, what do we have that will give you that Steve Vai tone? And him telling me, and then sort of committing those facts to memory, and then also, you know, paying attention. But I have to say, you know, I just don't pay attention to other people's pedals. So I really only know about ours or things that are hotly debated in our office or things like that. I sort of feel like that's a wonderful break that I have, that I'm not concerned with all that. You know what I mean? And I think that if I had all that stuff in my brain, it would be harder to get all my other stuff done.
Yeah, I think that's probably good. It's probably good for you just to focus on you and what you got to do.
And probably
the sort out everything product related, basically.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I will, you know, be asking questions like, why would anyone want this? to sort of uncover, you know, what angle should we take with this, or those sorts of things help me understand how we're going to approach our product launch or marketing or things like that. Yeah.
So I know Jamie told me the other day that you are the reason that the Palisades exists. Because you were like,
oh yeah,
too many people are asking for a tube screamer. You're gonna make a tube screamer, okay? And it's like,
well, I don't think I told him like that.
I probably put it like that.
Yeah, but I was like, why? Like, because I actually thought it was like tubes creamer.
Okay, right.
Not tubes screamer.
Right.
So like people would literally walk up to our NAMM booth and be like, which one's a tube screamer? And I'd be like, none of them. And they would just walk away. And I'd be like, what? Why? What is that? Right. Yeah. And so that was funny because he was like, you know, I've never really gotten into them, but maybe I should check out what all the fuss is about. So he started asking guys around the shop, like, do you have any tube screamers that I can check out? And one of our longtime employees, Joe Golden, was like, oh, yeah, I come from a tube screamer family. I got tube screamers. My mom's got tube screamers. My dad's got tube screamers. And like brought all these tube screamers in. And then Jamie went down so far down this rabbit hole. And I'd hear him like noodling around in the basement for hours and hours. Just kind of really enveloping himself in all of the tube screamer tones. And then, you know, a lot of times through development, he's telling me kind of almost ad nausea, like, blah, 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 this problem I got here. I want to make it like this. And I'm just sort of like, uh-huh, okay, sure. Oh, wow. You know, and then eventually it was finished and I was really blown away with it. I think it's one of our most attractive pedals. And I just felt really good about it. I still do. That's a good pedal.
Well, that was one of the first tube screamers that I was like, oh, that's different. Like, finally. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, you can tune the circuit in so many ways that there's lots of different ones out there. But that was the one that probably piqued my interest more than any other tube screamer that had came out at the time. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good take on it. Of course, that's what Earthquaker did with it. Why would they not have done that?
Well, it was also really funny because Jamie had for years been like, we're not making any tube screamers. And so he like felt this crazy obligation to like be like, I know I said I wouldn't do this, you know, but nobody cared.
No. And that was,
it was like, you said you wouldn't. Yeah. Yep.
Do you have a product? I think I asked the same thing of Jamie, or similar, maybe phrased a little differently. Do you have any products that you're kind of surprised that people like?
Well, I've heard people do really good and really awful things with all of our products. There are some that I like more than others. Let's see, what am I surprised that people like?
Or like, I'm kind of thinking of it like, so like my wife's not into any of this either. Like, so I'm like, oh yeah, this pedal totally destroys your signal. And she's like, why would you want that? Like, you know, I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, because it's awesome. You know, like sometimes coming at it from the outside, it's hard to understand why would somebody want to mangle their signal into madness.
Yeah. Well, okay. I can think of some things that, okay. So we have a couple one knob pedals, like the Acapulco Gold or the Eruptor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people will be like, there's only one knob. How do I control, you know, the volume or whatever? And I'm like, feel free to use any of the other volume knobs that you have at your discretion.
That is kind of funny.
Yeah. There's one there. There's one there.
Yeah. Just
a volume. Yeah. Yeah. But, I do like our more far out pedals, like the Data Corruptor or the Arpanoid or the Rainbow Machine. Like I have heard those used in really interesting ways. And those are definitely some that we'd get feedback from dealers. Like, you know, I'm not sure if anybody is going to want this. And And that's kind of how we feel too when we're putting out a product. We don't know what the market's going to do with it, especially if it's something that kind of didn't exist in pedal format before. So you just kind of put it out there and hope for the best. And yeah, a lot of dealers were surprised by how well a lot of those pedals performed.
Do you take any feedback from the dealers and go back to the guys at the shop and be like, listen, the dealers are telling me that we need, well, you know, for instance, maybe a tube screamer. The dealers are telling me we need this, so let's make one. Does that ever happen?
No, but we do. Okay, so Jamie is so, you know, in charge of the product design, and it really is what he works on, what he's inspired to work on. And I think that if somebody wanted us to never make a product, the best way would be to ask him to make it.
Okay. All right.
But we do in general consider very much what our dealers think about anything we're doing, or what our end consumers will think, or what other options they have, to make sure we're giving them a good product at a good price, you know, hopefully an exceptional product at a very good price.
Right. Right.
But, yeah, and dealers aren't so much like, you know, at least to my experience, telling us what people are asking for, but they don't have, you know. It's so many times that I'll be like, Jamie, so-and-so is looking for something that does this. And he was like, well, tell me what pedal that is. And I'll tell them and they'll be like, oh, I didn't know. So then they go get that pedal. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, you guys make so many things. Do you ever think that, like, maybe, you know, and this is just outside looking in, like most pedal companies don't have the range of SKUs that you guys do. Do you ever think that it's like you might need to like tone that down a little bit or get rid of some stuff, or, you know, what, you guys have a lot of product.
Yeah. Well, we do cut some pedals every year. We try and keep it around the same size overall of like the current lineup. But, you know, we don't have any sort of set targets. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is the maximum number of pedals we have. Although, like, it does get really annoying when we're trying to make boards with all of our pedals if we have more than we'll fit onto large pedal boards. So, yeah, I mean, I think that products kind of have a life cycle. And to some extent, the hard stuff happens at the beginning. You know what I mean? Later, you can just make them as long as people want them. And our sort of the way that we do things, we are making everything to demand. And then, of course, as soon as you discontinue something, that's when people really want it.
Of course.
But yeah, I'm not super concerned about how big or small our line sizes. And I think that I really trust Jamie when it comes to product development and things like that. Yeah, he's never let me down. So
this is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's got good vision, I think, in that.
Yeah. Incredible taste and very good vision. Yeah.
Yes. So do you have any like thing that you've learned going, you know, you've started from zero basically and got, you know, to be one of the more reputable companies in the industry. Do you have any lessons learned along the way, or things that happened that maybe other newer companies or smaller companies can look out for, or any advice for anyone, you know, who's starting out?
Yeah, let's see. Well, I think it's a really important to have sort of company principles and values that help you guide your decision making. If you have all of the values that are most important to you and make sure that you're respecting those with all of your decisions, then you can be confident that you're always, you know, on the right path. When you're sort of at a crossroads and trying to decide where to go, being able to fall back on things like that is really important. I also think it's really important for small business owners not to think that they can or have to do everything, and that they should, you know, be comfortable delegating things to other people and, you know, bringing other people into the mix to take on different tasks. I think that's a classic small business owner move, is trying to do everything themselves. And that's a great way to, you know, stress yourself into an early heart attack.
Yes, for sure.
So, you know, I've always been happy to bring more people on and sort of peel off parts of my role to establish a career for them. So that's one of the things that's kind of crazy is, you know, there's like 8 people doing what, you know, 1 or 2 people did for a long time. Let's see, what other advice would I have for people in the industry? I think it's just really important to think about sort of the ecosystem that we live in, you know?
Okay.
We're in the music industry. Our customers are musicians, they're music stores. Music stores and musicians both have been under, you know, a lot of changing circumstances. And it's just very important to be fair and to make sure that that industry can continue to survive. And it's by manufacturers having fair policies and making sure that they're not doing things that are detrimental to dealers. And so that's a lot of our philosophy.
What do you, when you say detrimental to dealers, what kind of practices do you mean by that?
Well, so maybe, trying to think of when we started our MAP policy. It's probably been a good 4 years. So MAP policies, minimum advertised pricing.
Right.
If you don't have a MAP policy or you don't enforce a MAP policy, then dealers are sort of in a price war with each other all the time. And they may be inclined to discount to the point that they're making like no money. And
just to get sort of by just to keep the cash flow coming type of thing.
Yeah. But if you have a policy and you enforce it, then it helps them protect their investment in your brand. And they know how much money they'll be able to make without being concerned that they'll be constantly, you know, asked to match prices from somebody undercutting them or things like that. And I think that that's been a critical factor to helping our company grow and dealers feel good about carrying our brand. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's really important. I think if anybody starts bringing on dealers, that is a very, very good point that you made. Because that is not something I even thought about early on talking to some of these guys until later. You know, they'd go and like, oh, yeah, this dealer's undercutting. Like, well, he shouldn't do that. Like, well, do you have a policy about that? Well, no.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really good kind of, and sometimes not thought about practice, I believe. That was really good.
Yeah, I think it's just really, you know, you've got to put yourself in the position of a dealer, you know, and brick and mortar dealers have always been our sort of lifeline. We actually don't sell direct. We haven't sold direct in about 4 years. And I would say that's a great decision. It helps push all of your business to your dealers and, you know, they don't feel like they're in competition with you. And then you're able to provide a higher level of customer service and things like that. Yeah, that's another thing we sort of learned along the way.
That was something I wanted to ask you about. Because it seems that, like, I knew you guys didn't sell direct. I didn't really think about it until recently, but somebody brought it up. I'm like, oh, they don't, do they? And and so my question is this, and I've talked to a lot of companies about this, and I really view the way that not just this industry, but just commerce in general is going more and more e-com every year. Whether it's Amazon or direct on the website or whatever the case may be, do you view that being a necessary change at some point, like in, you know, 10 years or who knows when, what the timeline is, that direct might be what people expect?
Um, I don't think that is what people will expect. I mean, first of all, we're like located in Akron, Ohio, which is not like the center of the universe. So like if we were in a place where there was like more people, maybe it would be a bigger deal.
Right.
But, you know, I think that people should support, you know, other businesses, whether they're their local store that they can walk over to or their preferred online shop that has the best customer service policy or, you know, whatever their preference is. But, you know, we've really never gotten complaints that we don't sell direct. You know, sometimes people will be confused, like they'll be think, oh, it's not available. And then we just put a button on our website that said, find a dealer. Right. And then that sort of solved that. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that when we looked at it, it was a very small percentage of our sales, but it was a much greater percentage of our energy. And that when we made the decision, it was due to constantly being backordered and not being able to, you know, adequately keep all of the inventory on the website updated. We wouldn't want a dealer to be waiting and somebody to be able to order it on the website and get it that day. So that was kind of our logic behind it. And, you know, we've since like eliminated our backlog and work from like a surplus, but we still would rather all the sales go through dealers. Like I said, it's really to support that ecosystem.
Right, right. Yes,
so
the music store is important. And I you see some publications that say like, I have many theories on this and I'd be curious to see if they align with yours, that, you know, guitar is dying and people aren't playing guitar anymore and they're citing, you know, giant guitar brands last, you know, sales are slowing and Guitar Center sales are slowing. And I'm going, to me, that's a bit short-sighted because I know that there's lots and lots of small brands eating into those big corporations, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So like, just because like Fender and Gibson are showing slowing sales and Guitar Center is showing slowing sales, that doesn't account for, you know, our local music shop, which is booming. They're not reporting their numbers to anybody. You know, and
right.
And, you know, some of the smaller pedal companies, like medium sized pedal companies that are doing really well, they're not reporting their numbers to any of these publications. And mm-hmm. Same with the guitar builders. So I feel like that's a lazy argument to say that the guitar is dying. I feel like that's ignoring a big slice of the picture, basically.
Well, it is like it is difficult to predict the future of like, will guitar sales continue to grow? You know, there's also so much used product out there. There's a lot of debate over, you know, the quality of new mass market guitars. Is that what is appealing to people? But I think from what I'm seeing, I mean, music is changing. Electronic music is a lot more prevalent. Our daughters are teenagers and they're fans of these like YouTube stars that have these like ridiculous songs about sweatshirts and stuff, and, you know, but it's kind of every generation thinks about their kids' music like that's not music. But, you know, in other areas like in Japan, where there is a much stronger component of music education in every child's life, you know, I feel more optimistic about their future musicians than I do in the U.S. where music programs are getting cut left and right. You know, it's hard to say where the industry is going and if it is a long-term trend. I also think, you know, there's probably a recession on the horizon, if not already coming right now, because it's been 10 years since we had a recession and you just inevitably will have one.
Yeah,
so
I agree with you. I don't want to agree with you, but I do. I think that is pending, yeah. Unfortunately.
Well, if people feel insecure, they're not as likely to spend money on things that are, you know, an accessory or an instrument or things that are not you know, food and shelter and healthcare and the most critical things. So
is there anything that since we both kind of share that viewpoint, is there anything that you think you can do as a company to try to prepare for that? Or is it just you kind of got to roll with it when it gets here?
I think like on our side, we're always trying to look at, well, what could derail us right now, you know? And there are, you know, some pretty massive things that could affect anybody who's, you know, importing parts from China.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, fortunately, there's a 90-day extension on whatever proposed tariffs are. But that's sort of a big thing that we'd need to consider. So I've sort of, for years, all we needed to think of was how do we increase our capacity to meet demand? And now I think more, okay, what if things go the other way? What changes would I make to preserve our organization? And I feel ultimately like we're very well prepared because our production methods are very adaptable to demand.
Okay.
And so it's just understanding if it's a short-term or long-term change in demand and implementing changes based on that. But as opposed to brands that are mass manufactured and they may need to order a certain quantity of pedals and then they have all this stuff on the shelves, we can be very adaptable to, you know, what demand is asking us for. And that's a good position to be in.
Yes, it is. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's if you got to order, you know, 5,000-6,000 pre-populated things and have it all sitting there. And then it's like, and hopefully that one isn't a stinker of a seller, or hopefully the, you know, economy stays okay. And so you're not just left with a bunch of essentially useless parts that you can't get rid of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a really cool position to be in from that perspective.
Yeah.
Was that intentional, or did that kind of happen just because that's how you started processing things?
Well, part of it was Jamie's philosophy, and it was also, you know, we're not a super sophisticated manufacturer, you know, like we don't have all of those sophisticated machines to do manufacturing for us. I know that a huge part of our identity is making the pedals ourselves here at Akron. And I don't know how much a consumer cares about any of that, but it's something that we care about a lot. So I think it was sort of an organic way that we developed that turned out to be an advantage. And I just don't know anybody else that does it the way that we do it. So we're not able to like look at somebody and be like, oh, we'll just do it like that. We have to figure everything out on our own.
Right. That seems like it's been that way since the beginning. You sort of figured everything you do out. There was no one to look to. There wasn't a you to look to at the time.
No.
That's very, very interesting. I had a pretty good question in amongst the jokes on the Facebook group.
Uh-huh.
People just like to post nonsense GIFs co.
Okay.
But another Blake Lawson asked, how hard is it to balance creativity with sales? Which I thought was actually pretty interesting.
Well, like I said, I don't think that we've ever been able to look at something and know how the market is going to receive it. We always hope for the best. I do think that Jamie having like total control over what he's working on is the best thing for creativity. You know, there's no one to say, you can't do that. You know, he is able to take it as far as he wants. So for us, I think that we're maybe different than other companies. And I don't mean other pedal companies. I mean like other for-profit companies that, you know, if we were looking at what our biggest concern was, it wouldn't be profit. It would be doing the best job we can. So that means making the best pedals that we can. So it sort of flips, you know, the equation a little bit when you look at it that way. But
yeah, I do understand that. And One time I heard it was Josh Scott. He I can't remember if he was doing an interview or if I heard him tell somebody this at NAMM, and I thought it was a really interesting perspective. It was talking to who was he talking to? I can't remember. Anyway, he was giving some advice for a newer pedal company, and it's like, what was the biggest piece of advice that he could give was to just stick around. He's like, it's going to be hard just to stick around at some point. And he's like, and if you can, you're going to be in a better position. You know, just really think about like, how can you stay around? Do you think that that's accurate?
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
it's kind of a weirdly phrased question, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think that. Well, I listened to a couple of your podcasts after hearing that I was going to be a guest on one. And no. One thing that kind of struck me that I didn't hear from other people, I was like, why do they make it sound like it's so easy? Because it's not easy. It's really hard. Like, you're dealing with all sorts of problems all the time. That's what owning a business is just solving all these different problems.
Right.
So I think so long as you're still engaged in the act of solving all those problems, you've got a really good chance of figuring it out and working past it. And it is interesting to look back and think about how at various stages, what our biggest problem was and how we were able to resolve it. But you're never going to be in a situation where everything is just sunshine and roses. There's always going to be something.
Yes, there's always an issue somewhere.
Like, yes, exactly.
Nothing's ever perfect. That's a
interesting.
So when you look back at some of those struggles at different times, what were some like ones that stick out in your mind and how did you get around them?
Well, let's see. So I'm recording this in our old shop, where we were literally crammed in here, like sardines, like one toilet for 30 people.
Oh, whoa.
And, we were doing great, but our biggest problem was our enclosures were, it was difficult to get them on time and to the quality that we wanted them. And so we embarked on bringing all of that in house and got CNC machines and printers and drill presses and worked to design our own enclosure mold and find good suppliers for that and local powder coaters and had to work through all of the learning curve of all of that. But now we never have a problem with enclosures. And there's three people who full time are working to make sure all of our enclosures are perfect. But it did involve, you know, moving into another building and, you know, financing equipment and doing things like that that were pretty far outside of our comfort zone at that time. But then, you know, it helped us understand, okay, we can do this. We can take on new things. And it's really been great. I think having as much as you can in-house is the best possible thing.
Yeah, especially from a quality controls perspective. I know that you're not alone in that struggle with the enclosures, and that others have come to a similar solution. Like,
yeah,
well, if you want something done right, I guess you got to do it yourself type of thing.
Yeah.
And that is kind of scary because like you said, that is a completely different process than soldering together PCBs. It's way.
Oh better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Was there anything involved in that you were like, I can't believe this is as complicated as it is, it's just drilling holes in boxes? Or was it just you had somebody helping you along the way? Or how did you figure all that out?
Jamie was really more involved in that than I was. I was sort of like, can you just tell me how much money we need?
Okay.
But I know that, you know, we sent one of our guys to CNC school. So he went in the evenings for like 3 months and got certified to operate a CNC machine. But that was, of course, after we were already using it.
Right.
Yeah, I know that there was a big learning curve with that. Kind of one of the most surprising things was that it was difficult to find local powder coaters that were like willing to work with us, because, you know, Akron was known as the rubber capital of the world due to our proximity to Detroit. We made all these tires, and there was a lot of industry that was revolving around providing to, you know, parts for the automotive industry. And then that all died a long time ago. There's, you know, companies that have survived, but they're not that interested in doing a lot of little things. They might want to do a few big things, or, you know, it was, we were just seemed to be a weird size of what our demand was and what price we needed. But we were eventually able to find some that would work with us. But that I didn't think was going to be so hard. You know, there's like 20 powder coating facilities in the Yellow Pages. And we actually had to kind of expand our net to go, I think the closest is like a 45-minute drive.
Oh, wow. That is really surprising.
Because
I've always thought, I'm like, we got a lot of powder coaters over here in my neck of the woods. And I thought, that wouldn't be that hard to sort out. But I guess, you know, if they're not set up to do those things, they're set up to do an automotive frame or something.
Right.
It's a different, totally different process. That's very,
And we have a lot of different colors. Like, we quickly realized we would be too much for any single powder coater. So we have a few.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was like the biggest delay that we hit.
Kind of going on a different route here. What is one of the coolest things that happened to you as a result of working at EQD?
Definitely the travel that we get to do. So Jamie and I have got to do a lot of trips where we're exploring different markets or evaluating different distributors. And so we end up finding ourselves in all these far-flung places. And I love to travel. I love to experience other cultures. So that by far is my favorite. We've also got to meet some really incredible people. I don't know if you follow any of our YouTube videos, but we do this series called Show Us Your Junk, where we go around to different studios. And I'm always just so like in awe of the engineers and producers of these studios. They're like magic to me.
Right.
And so that's been another really amazing experience.
That's pretty cool. Does any particular one stand out in your mind, experience or place?
Oh, wow. Mark Mothersbaugh's studio, being that Devo's from Akron and everyone always idolized Devo. And it's a really amazing studio, too. And it's in this round building that used to be a plastic surgeon.
Oh, wow.
And then it's just full of all of this incredible, wacky stuff. So that was a really special one to me. But there's really been a lot. I think that everyone that I went on, and I wasn't at all the shoots when we did that, but you can hear me laughing in the background of all the ones that I was, and that drives me crazy. I'm like, shut up, Julie.
That's what that was.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yep.
That's cool. That is really neat that you guys get the opportunity to do that. And then do you see when you like, so you're exposed to a completely different side than what a lot of, well, even like your customers would think about when you go to some of these like bigger distributors and stuff. Is it like, I know I've seen some behind the scenes stuff from like Taman and things like that. And it's like, is it ever just like, whoa, this is a whole nother level of stuff? Or you just seen some kind of crazy things?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we've seen the full spectrum, you know. But yeah, Taman was really incredible. Their level of like robotics that they have for order fulfillment and, you know, the way that they are so like data driven. That was really cool. Sweetwater, I think, would fall under the same boat of just being really impressive technology wise and staffing wise. Both of those have some similarities. You know, they're kind of out of the way. Taman is in this very small town in Germany, and there's really nothing near it. No major cities within a few hours drive.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so that makes it kind of even more fascinating, you know? But yeah, I mean, you can't you can't just apply your American ideas to how things work in other places. You need to be open-minded and go and see it and experience it for yourself to really get it. And so that's something that I just think is really cool. Being there and meeting people and talking to people and seeing stores and seeing bands is a really great way to understand how our industry translates in different areas.
I gotcha.
So,
yeah. That's pretty fascinating. A little bit jealous. That's kind of cool.
Something that really blew my mind was just how amazing all of the music stores in Japan are.
Oh, really?
There, every single one is like paradise, just like this next level customer service. And like shoplifting is not a thing in Japan. People would just not shoplift. So being in a store where that's not a concern is kind of interesting, where more emphasis can be placed on like the function of the display as opposed to the security of it. Really interesting.
Yeah, I hope to get over there at some point. I've heard that the stores, you're not the first person who's told me the stores.
You really should.
Yeah.
It's the best. I love Japan.
I want to check it out and I want to eat ramen all day long.
Yes, do it.
Oh man, that sounds so good.
It's
definitely lunchtime. what is something, we're getting down to kind of the last few minutes here, but I just thought of,
sure.
What is something that might be surprising to the customers or the outsiders looking in about Earthquaker as a company?
Well, I think maybe they don't realize how labor intensive, and how much care we take with all of our builds. So really, everything is done in-house except the powder coating. That might be very surprising to them. They also might not realize we're as big of an organization as we are, having so many employees. They might think that's interesting. I know like when bands come through, they get really excited to see the shop, and I'm always a little flabbergasted by that. Like, why is this so awesome to you? It's just a drill. But they are like, wow.
Well, they want to see, they want to see how the sausage is made, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I think part of it is, and I mean, I can say this from, my limited experience is like, when you have these things that you really love, whether they're whatever part of your chain, like, the guitars, the pedals, or the amps, even like the cables, it's like, I really want to see that. The first time I remember watching strings getting made, and I'm like, wow, that's so cool. Like, really, it's just metal wrapped around metal, but it's so like, as a musician, it's like, you have this sort of intimate relationship with your instrument and the tools you use to like make these sounds. And so to see them like sort of being born is very interesting. And I think when you're as close to it as you are, maybe some of the magic isn't there that it is for other people.
Yeah, maybe.
That's the way I feel about it anyway. I don't know. I love pedals, and I've seen them being made many times by many different people using different processes, and it always fascinates me. It's like, oh, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
That's I don't know. It was kind of a ramble. But so this is the point in the show that I kind of like to have people, if you have anything that's on your mind, whether it's something you want to talk about as a company, something you want to say personally, like if there was a billboard where you could show everyone in the world something, what would it say?
Oh man. I think I would love for everybody to just be more polite and respectful to each other. I just think, and especially in the world of like online pedal reviews and things like that, sometimes people feel like they should just say whatever they think. And I think that they should think about what they say and be polite and respectful. Like if someone gets up there and does a pedal demo, don't tell them they're garbage. Like, taste is subjective. You know, you may not like their playing style. You may not like that pedal, but that doesn't mean that person is a bad person or a bad musician. You just don't like it. So I would ask people to be more polite to each other.
I like that.
And think about each other's feelings a little bit more.
I like that. And I agree. There's a lot of things that get said on the internet. One thing I've tried to say before, kind of piggybacking off of that, is if you wouldn't say that to the person standing in front of them, then maybe you just shouldn't say it.
Yeah.
Because
it sort of astounds me at how nasty people can get. And it's like, if you hate this, don't torture yourself. Don't watch this. Just keep going.
Yes. Scroll harder.
There's other things that you might like.
Yes. Scroll harder. So, as some people say, like, keep scrolling. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Nice. I like that. So a lot of people use that as an opportunity for a company plug, which is fine. But I'm the real goal with that question is always to like, is there, what's on your mind? You know, what's on your
mind? Okay. I'll do a company plug for
you. Okay. Go for it.
Earthquaker devices. There's no reason not to try them.
I like that. There is no reason not to try them.
Yeah, there isn't.
I have some, and I can tell you there's no reason not to try them.
That's right.
Good times. All right. Last question. And this is the big one.
Oh, no.
Yeah, this is the one that people get really worried about. And this could, as I've said before, make or break the company. So you're sitting down, right?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay. What kind of pizza do you like?
I'm not that picky. I just don't like green peppers.
That's it?
But I would, yeah. Pizza is basically a desperation food for me. Like, there's no other option. It's only pizza. So I wouldn't like be like, let's get pizza for no other reason. But, I do like, I like all kinds of pizza, mushroom pizza. I really like some green olives on a pizza. I like a white pizza. You know, if somebody has got some specialty pizza, I'll try that. I'm not picky, but I only just a few years ago realized that I just don't like green peppers. I ate them forever and was just kind of like, blech. And then I was like, you know what? I don't have to eat these.
I'm an adult.
I don't like them. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
That's interesting. You said that pizza is a desperation food. So that's almost as close to like anything as, I'm like, you wouldn't seek pizza out. Is that what?
No, I've never been like, I'm hungry for pizza. I've never had that feeling.
Oh, so that's interesting.
Usually when I eat pizza, I'm like, oh, afterwards, like, oh, this is why I don't like pizza. I feel like terrible.
I have to confess something. I ate way more than my share of pizza at the bowling party last year.
Good for you. Good for you.
I was like, I'm starving. Then they were like, you've already had six pieces. I don't care. I need more. It's just sitting there. No one's eating it.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. But I hope you'll let me come back this year.
Oh, you're welcome to come back.
I'm so
You're welcome to come back. We actually are not welcome back at that bowling alley. So I've secured a new bowling alley, which is also an old bowling alley. We've done it there before.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know what we did, but when I tried to reserve the date this year, they were pretty clear that it was not available for us.
Wow. That,
I know.
Jamie told me that too. And I was like, I didn't think it was that wild. I don't know.
I didn't think so either. I don't know what we did.
I left fairly early. So I was like, maybe somebody punched somebody after I left or something. I don't know.
No, nothing like that happened. Like,
well,
yeah.
I'm glad you got an old one. I the first year I was at NAMM, we were in the fancy bowling alley, and that was
cool. Yeah, we'll be
that was cool, but I like
we'll be one. Back at the fancy bowling alley this year.
We're at the fancy one? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that'll still be fun. That will be
It will be fun.
Yeah. I'm very excited.
Awesome.
All right.
Awesome.
Well, I guess that puts us right at the mark, so I guess I'll wrap this thing up.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. This was awesome.
No problem.
All right, everyone. For Julie, this is Blake, and as always, folks, good luck and good tones. There it is. There's another one in the can. I keep saying that every time, and I try to think of something new to say, but I just can't think of anything. So, in the can, it is.
thank you for tuning in. Thank you for sharing this with your buddies. Thank you for being involved in the community and all that good stuff. And another big thank you to Julie for taking the time to come on, because I know she's got better things to do than to talk to me. And if you'd like a little more of the conversation, there is more. We talked for a little bit longer, and it is available over on Patreon. So go to patreon.com/tonemob, where for just $5 a month, you can get extra Tone Mobbery and extra episodes for your ears. Just for your ears. Only for the Patreon people. And in this one, we talk about Triscuits. So you know that it got real and it got, intense. We're talking Triscuits. It's a very serious thing. So yes, patreon.com/tonemob, and you can get more Tone Mobbery. So it's there for you to listen to if you should choose. And we've got, 25 back episodes. Some of them are quite long. The one with Jamie from last week was like 45 minutes. So, there's a lot of nuggets over there. So go check that out if that's a thing that you would like. But thank you for just listening to the regular episode. If nobody was tuning in, there would be absolutely no reason to do this. So thank you very much, and please share this with somebody that might enjoy it. All right, talk to you next time. Bye-bye. One last thing before we totally sign off here. I just want to remind you that if you do any shopping at Stringjoy, that's Stringjoy Guitar Strings made in Nashville, that will help me out as well. As I've said for years, I'm heavily involved in that company, and I really do think they're making the best products on the market. So if you would like to try custom strings, go to tonemob.com/stringjoy and check them out today. I seriously, seriously, seriously love what the team down there is doing. I help them out with all kinds of things, and by you supporting them, you are also supporting me as well. And hey, you need some strings, so why not get some custom strings just for your guitar and playing style? Again, the link for that is tonemob.com/stringjoy, and that will take you right to their website, and you can do all your shopping through there, and that will help everyone involved out. So thank you very much. Talk to you next time. We are brought to you by the wonderful folks at Gun Street Wiring Shop. Yes, Gun Street Wiring Shop. I've talked about them before. I used to say based out of Bend, Oregon, but guess what? Sean moved to my neck of the woods. Sean's in Portland. Sean is awesome and has helped me with a bunch of stuff lately. And if you have wiring needs for your guitar, he can help you too. If you want to get weird with it, he can get weird. If you just need to spruce things up a little bit, there's your guy. He takes all the guesswork out of doing your guitar wiring, and he makes it simple, and his customer service is top-notch, and I can't say enough good things about Gun Street as a company. I really respect Sean and what he's all about, and the product is top-notch. I've got 3 different guitars that now have Gun Street harnesses in them, and I could not be happier. So go to GunStreetWiringShop.com and check them out.